Today, we're taking a look at the Tupolev TB-3. This chunky beast was a four-engine Soviet heavy bomber developed in the late 1920s. It was the first all-metal, four-engine monoplane bomber to enter service in the world, and it transformed the capabilities of the Soviet Air Force. Now, there aren't that many photos of this particular plane to be found, but as you can see on the screen, it has been rendered beautifully in 3D thanks to the sponsor of today's video, War Thunder. War Thunder is an online military vehicle combat game. It's free to play on PC, Xbox Series XS, PS5, and the previous console generation, and it is fully cross-platform, meaning players on all of these platforms play on the same servers. War Thunder gives you access to a massive selection of over 2,000 historically accurate, playable vehicles, ranging from tanks to aircraft, helicopters, and naval vessels. With these vehicles, you take part in massive combined arms battles across a variety of battlefields and game modes. Depending on your preferred playstyle and experience, War Thunder's intense PvP battles can be played in a number of different ways. Arcade mode gives you fast-paced but easy-to-handle action. Realistic mode makes for more tactical and challenging gameplay. And my personal favorite mode, especially for aircraft, is Simulator. This puts you right in the cockpit, and combined with a VR headset and a sturdy flight stick makes for an amazing experience. But you don't need a fancy gaming setup to enjoy War Thunder. One of its biggest advantages is the fact that you can still enjoy this game on a potato quality laptop with nothing but a mouse and a keyboard. The game is incredibly accessible, which is why it has attracted over 50 million players from all over the world. To get started with War Thunder, click on the link in the description below to sign up for free, and in doing so, you'll receive a free premium tank, aircraft, and ship, along with a 7-day account boost. Despite doing YouTube as a full-time job, I still have some spare time to enjoy this game, so who knows, you might bump into me flying some sort of obscure plane on a weekend. And if you do, I'm sorry. But enough casual bragging about my supposed flying prowess in a digital game with zero actual flying qualifications, let's instead take a closer look at the TB-3. Its story begins in 1925 with the Soviet Air Force. Having requested Tupolev to produce what would become the TB-1 in 1923, the Soviet Union's first mass-produced bomber, and an all-metal one at that, they then returned with another request in 1925. They wanted a four-engine all-metal bomber built along similar principles to the TB-1. It had to be both viable as a land plane, a seaplane, or a ski plane for winter operations, and it must have a power output of at least 2,000 horsepower. After initial testing of a simple wind tunnel model was complete, Tupolev was approved to launch a project to fully develop the new bomber, which at the time was designated as the ANT-6 by Tupolev, and later the TB-3 by the VVS. The project was to be managed under Tupolev's overall direction by Petlyakov, who was also busy working on the TB-1 project. In fact, the two aircraft went through their prototyping and construction process almost in parallel. That being said, it took a while for both projects to build up momentum and actually get underway. The TB-1 suffered from material shortages, which led to production delays, something I talked about in the video that covers that plane, and the new four-engine bomber also suffered this problem. However, this was not the only cause for its long development time. On the one hand, the VVS was being typical of most interwar air services and kept changing its requirements for the new bomber, and on the other, there was the problem of logistics. For most of the 1920s, the Soviet Union did not possess the required facilities in which it could build the TB-3 airframes, nor supply them with the required equipment in the numbers requested. As a result of this, development on the bomber was so slow that several other Tupolev projects took to the air despite being started after it, namely the ANT-7, 9, and 10. Finally, on the 3rd of December 1929, the first detailed model of the ANT-6 was tested in a wind tunnel, and in March of 1930, a full-scale mock-up and then a prototype was ordered, almost 5 years after the initial commencement of the project. Much like its predecessor, the TB-3 prototype would become the largest aircraft built in the Soviet Union at the time, and it was among the largest aircraft in the world in terms of wingspan. The wing repeated the profile of that found on the TB-1, but the ailerons, extending from the outer engines to the tips, did not project outwards. Structurally, the wing was made out of a 7-meter central section that was built integrally to the fuselage, and four outer sections that could be removed for rail transport. The wing was built up around four spars that ran from tip to tip. These comprised upper and lower booms that were joined by vertical and horizontal box and channel sections, and these were reinforced by gussets of sheet metal and steel connectors at the joints. The end result was an unappealing, but undeniably strong, internal structure. Much like the wing, the fuselage was a direct extrapolation of that of the TB-1, with the main difference being that it had a more rectangular cross-section with far less taper towards the tail. Two prominent top-hat longerons projected on each side from nose to tail, and six of the 13 A-frames used in the structure were also formed into corrugated sheet bulkheads, and they were large enough to accommodate 1.5-meter tall doors that connected each section of the fuselage. In the initial design of the TB-3 that the prototype was built around, it was to have a crew of six. In the top of the nose, there was an open cockpit for the gunner, and below this was a lower compartment, well supplied with windows, for the navigator and bomb aimer. Next came the side-by-side open cockpits for the pilots, again free to take in the icy cold Siberian winds, followed by a compartment for the engineer, with separate engine and instrument consoles on each side of a central gangway. Next came the bomb bay, with two pairs of flat rectangular doors in the belly, between the bulkheads to which the undercarriage struts were attached. In the initial design, the aircraft was to be mounted on a similar undercarriage to the TB-1, but this would be changed several times over the aircraft's history. Lastly, behind the wing on the upper section of the fuselage were two open cockpits for the central gunners, one of whom also acted as a radio operator. Like the nose cockpit, these were fitted with scarf rings for the machine guns, but the prototype had no armament or military equipment. By the time construction of the prototype had begun, its design requirements had changed, owing to the passage of time and the changing moods of the Soviet Air Force. Tupolev and Petlyakov's work was made easier by the dropping of the seaplane requirement, as that was now being met by the ANT-8 flying boat. Power plant requirements had also changed several times, and while the Soviet-built M-17 engines were being worked on, they were not yet ready, and the decision was made to fit the prototype with four 600-horsepower Curtiss Conqueror water-cooled V-12s. The engines were mounted on steel trusses ahead of a firewall on the front wing spar. The wing was deep enough that, when needed, an engineer, who didn't suffer from claustrophobia, could crawl through the wing and gain access to them with relative ease. This was something they would have to get used to, as the only way of checking the fuel levels was to also crawl through the wing and check the fuel level indicators. And the bomber had 14 of them, so it was quite a tedious affair. Supporting what was rapidly becoming a large, heavy engineer-filled plane was an undercarriage that shared much of its design, again, with the TB-1. The weight of the aircraft was taken by a vertical strut from the axle to the second spar, and triangular bracing was provided by a third strut between the axle and the bottom of the fuselage. The vertical strut featured housings for the 12 rubber bungee shock absorbers, which, along with the huge 2-meter diameter wheels, would support the massive bulk of the airframe. Production of the prototype was rapid, and it was completed in just under 6 months. Ground tests began on the 20th of November 1930, and on the 22nd of December it was prepared for its first flight. This flight almost ended in disaster for the testing crew when heavy vibrations from the engines and the skids on the ground caused the starboard throttle levers to gradually be moved to the closed positions. This caused the aircraft to slew to the right, where it narrowly avoided returning to its hangar in a most unplanned and violent fashion before test pilot Mikhail Gromov was able to hold the throttle open to complete the takeoff in relative safety. Following this, the rest of the flight was problem-free and deemed a success. By February of 1931, the prototype was successfully taking off, flying and landing with its wheeled undercarriage, and as its performance was within the VVS requirements, it was ordered into production as the TB3. This made it the world's first all-metal, four-engine cantilever wing bomber to enter full-scale production. Though the M17 engines were now available, pressure on these going into the TB1s, which were already in production, led to the first TB3s being re-engined with BMW 6 engines. The armament and military equipment was now also installed, for obvious reasons. The internal bomb bay still resembled that of the TB1, but it now had a central gangway installed, each side of which was a series of horizontal bomb racks. These could carry up to 28 100-kilogram bombs. If the internal bomb bay wasn't used, external bomb racks could be added to the wings and fuselage. This would allow the TB3 to carry various loads with a maximum bomb load of 5 tons, which for 1931 gave it the largest bomb-carrying capacity for any production aircraft in the world. The TB3's defensive armament consisted of a series of twin-mounted, drum-fed DA machine guns in each gunner station. In addition to this, production TB3s introduced a new feature that Tupolev was to later suggest for several even larger bomber projects: extendable wing turrets. This sort of turret design is often referred to as a dustbin turret, sometimes because of their appearance, and sometimes because they were considered to be literally rubbish on some designs, owing to various problems. These turrets had already been successfully tested on the ANT-6, and several TB3s now had them installed as well. Their location required the unfortunate gunner to crawl through the wing structure to reach the turret, which was located near the outer engine. Because of their location, these turrets were manned by assistant engineers charged with supervising the engines and reading the gauges on the fuel tanks. For operation, the turret could be manually cranked down until it was wholly below the wing, and then cranked to the left or the right while the gunner aimed his machine gun. Probably quite the workout, as this all had to be done by hand. The turret had side windows, and the gunner was provided with 14 magazines for the gun, and in an emergency, the turret could be jettisoned, ideally with the gunner not being inside. Subsequent tests showed that whilst they caused some level of drag, posed a frostbite risk to the gunners, and in general looked positively hideous, the turrets were useful for defence, as the bomber lacked a tail gunner. So the design stuck around, at least for a time. The first production aircraft rolled out of the factory on the 4th of January 1932. Unfortunately, by this point, the production aircraft had grown rather heavy, and this resulted in poor flight performance when these first units were delivered. The cause of the weight gain was from numerous things: the switching from imported to locally produced alloys for much of the airframe, the addition of combat equipment not accounted for in some places, steps, brackets, partitions, and seats not found on the prototype, the use of heavy electric cables despite currents being trivial, and the poor quality of inexperienced factory workers. As a result of this, an urgent weight reduction program was initiated, apparently with complete disregard to safety. Wherever possible, the structure was simplified, wing ribs were removed, and in some extreme cases, the thickness of the fuselage structure was reduced. Despite these measures, when the plane flew again, these changes did not result in any catastrophic structural failures, merely various cracks that were then arrested by drilling holes into various parts of the airframe. I wish I was making that up. Disaster apparently avoided, production went full steam ahead, and by 1933, factory number 22 was producing two TB3s every 3 days. By now, they were powered by the M17 engine that had finally entered mass production, and by the start of the year, nearly 400 TB3s had already been built and delivered. This meant that the Soviet Union now had the most powerful bomber force in the world, a distinction that they would hold for most of the 1930s. Despite having a potent bomber force, the VVS was still hungry for more improvement, specifically range. The Soviet Union itself was vast, and it had potential enemies on both its eastern and western borders. Because of this, range was considered more important than payload among many senior officers. Tupolev engineers were faced with a choice on how to provide said range: increase power or reduce drag. The latter option was explored first. In early 1933, a production aircraft was modified for special trials. Everything possible was done to reduce drag. All armament and bomb racks were removed, as well as antennas and other drag-inducing objects, and the main wheels were housed in streamlined fairings. The result was a disappointing gain of just 4.5% in speed and range, in exchange for costly modifications that made a bomber basically combat ineffective. Experiments with increasing power eventually yielded better results, though at first this was not the case. Initially, trials were done with the new Mikulin M34 engines. Again, these were water-cooled V12s, but with improved four-valve cylinders and the addition of a supercharger. Though they boasted increased power over the old M17s, the increase in speed and range was negligible. A follow-up test was conducted, with the aircraft stripped of its dustbin turrets and a reduced crew to save weight, but this was equally disappointing. Though the M34 was more reliable than the M17, as well as being more powerful, the only performance advantage was a higher top speed at lower altitudes. Climb, ceiling, range, and handling were worsened, and the engine's heavier weight and higher RPMs led to uncomfortable vibrations and excessive noise, all of which made for an intolerable experience for the pilots, whose open cockpits were closest to the engines and their propellers. Salvation was found in the M34R engine, which featured a reduction gear. It was hoped that driving a larger propeller at a slower speed would both improve performance and solve the noise and vibration issues. It did. Despite the added weight of the improved engine and large propeller, the takeoff run was reduced, the climb to 3,000 meters went from 29 minutes down to 17, the top speed increased by almost 20 kilometers an hour, and the noise from the propellers was significantly lessened, much to the relief of the pilots. Following successful trials, this new engine and propeller arrangement was installed on all future TB3s, and many existing models were also modified to the updated configuration. Two other distinct modifications that were made in the 1930s was the fitting of four-blade propellers to the inboard engines, which improved takeoff performance, and the addition of a tail gunner. Previously, the fuselage had terminated at the sternpost, but this was now modified for additional width to support the gunner and their equipment. The rudder was redesigned, the entire lower part being removed, and the upper section extended. Initially, this station also featured twin guns, but with the new Chicasse machine guns arriving in large numbers, a single version of this unit would replace the old twin arrangement. These new belt-fed guns boasted a fire rate of 1,800 rounds per minute, and so a single Chicasse machine gun had more firepower than two of the old drum-fed DA guns. Though they were amongst the heaviest and largest bombers employed in the 1930s, the TB3s are most remembered for their more unconventional experimental roles. Many TB3s were used to test new equipment and procedures, and from 1932 onwards, this was done with frightening rapidity. Among being used to test a new autopilot system, they were used to test blind flying instruments. Apparently, this was once done in blizzard conditions with the world's bravest test pilot. They were used to test the feasibility of transporting light tanks by air. And one even had 76mm field guns installed. No photos of this latter event can be found, but apparently a pair of 76mm guns were installed on the wings of a TB3, with a pair of gunners crammed into said wing taking firing orders from the pilot, who had the task of somehow aiming the things. The fact that this was done to only one plane speaks volumes as to its actual success and feasibility. A slightly saner experiment involved the installation of spherical, power-driven gun turrets in 1941, along with the testing of an advanced fire control system that allowed three powered turrets to be operated remotely, but the most spectacular and most famous experiments to feature the TB3 were the ones involving parasite fighters. Vakhistrov Zvieno, and I hope I pronounced that right, organised a series of experiments between 1933 and 1935 that were conducted in numbered stages that increased in complexity. Z2 comprised a TB3 carrying an I-5 fighter above each wing, and a third above the fuselage. Z3 involved IZ fighters being suspended underneath each wing, and Z5 involved an IZ fighter taking off independently and docking with the mothership, something it did in a world first on the 23rd of March 1935. All of this culminated with a TB3 taking off in 1935 with no less than four planes attached to it, two I-15s above the wing, two I-16s below, and then a fifth plane then flew up and attached to the bottom of the fuselage once the TB3 was airborne. After climbing to operational altitude, all five planes successfully detached from the mothership without incidents in what could only have been a very interesting spectacle. Amazingly, this party trick was actually used in action during the Second World War. Operational missions flown by the I-16s of the 32nd Regiment often involved said planes dropping from the wings of a TB3 to carry out dive bombing attacks. Most of these missions were conducted around Romania, with some notable successes in striking bridges across the Danube River. Unfortunately, not a great deal of information is readily available about the service life of the TB3, but what there is paints a good picture. With over 800 being built, they would see service throughout the 1930s, and in fact all the way up to the end of the Second World War in some cases. TB3s featured at the Battle of Khalkhin Gol against Imperial Japan, and the Winter War with Finland. A couple of TB3s were captured by Finnish forces, and their photos contribute a fair amount to the total number of photos that exist for the aircraft. But the TB3's biggest military involvement was in the Second World War, following the German invasion of the Soviet Union. By the summer of 1941, the TB3 was well and truly showing its age, with numerous more advanced bomber designs already in service. In fact, it had been withdrawn from service in 1939, and many TB3s had been converted into a transport variant that was known as the G2. Some of these transports were used to haul cargo and equipment between the many remote communities of the USSR, but some were also being actively used to train Soviet paratroopers. But so numerous was the TB3's production run that the VVS still had 516 operational aircraft in reserve when Operation Barbarossa kicked off. As most of these aircraft were stationed with reserve units, or in storage, far to the east, they avoided the calamitous losses experienced by other air units in the opening weeks of the war with Germany. This meant that for a good while they were some of the most numerous bombing aircraft available to the VVS, and TB3s were employed in night bombing missions during much of the conflict. They were also sometimes used for day bombing, when things got desperate, but their obsolete design and slow speed led to appalling losses by a combination of enemy fighters and anti-aircraft fire. Though they were outperformed by more modern, sleeker designs, the TB3's contribution as a bomber, troop carrier, and logistics aircraft was significant. So much so that a trio of them featured in post-war victory parades in the Soviet Union. Though no examples of these metal giants survive today, a fate sadly shared by many other large aircraft of this time, their contribution towards the development of Soviet aviation has cemented them as one of the most important heavy aircraft of the interwar period. Once again, thank you to War Thunder for sponsoring today's video, and providing me with their wonderful model of the TB3. Don't forget to register your account for free using the link below to get those free premium benefits. And if you're a plane person, which, to be fair, you probably are if you're watching my videos, you might bump into me in the virtual skies. As always, thank you all so much for watching, and a big thank you, of course, to the patrons, with a special shout-out to Kevin, Deliardo, Bane, FB, Christopher R. Tronathon, Eric Heinemann, John Austin Jr., Ray Colotta, Keith Tarrier, Green Sea Ships, Northlinks Webs, MCT, and Ted Parsons, for their support as Wing Commander tier patrons. Thank you all so much, and I'll catch you all next time. Goodbye.